From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
In the 69th Village.
It's not the dog patch, it's just dog patch.
Coming up, we'll learn about the true costs of producing one of America's favorite foods.
We make hamburgers because that's what Americans still like to buy the most of.
Then we talk with author Raj Patel about more hidden food costs and how global food aid may be causing more harm than good.
And it's being loaded off the boat and it's been given away for free. What does that do to the farmer? Of course, it wipes them out.
And we'll meet a local singer whose global sound is tied directly to where we live.
It's an ocean city. There's ports. People are leaving and coming all the time. It's part of this, the city's nature always has been.
That and a tribute to a cultural icon. Today on Cross Currents, stay with us. There's a price war going on at your local burger joints. Since the start of the new year, McDonald's has run a promotion in which customers can buy two items, including a McDouble cheeseburger, for $2. Burger King immediately answered by offering five items, including a bacon cheeseburger, for $4. At the same time, some fast food outlets are going the opposite direction, charging more for hamburgers grown in ways that seem more sustainable. It can be confusing for consumers who don't know the true cost of the food we eat. KALW's Ryan Miller reports on hamburgers.
In the TV commercial world, sex sells. And this one sells burgers. It shows a woman walking through a farmer's market.
Nothing between me and my 100% all natural.
She's practically naked. Au naturel. That's the point.
Introducing the all-natural burger, the first ever in fast food. With no antibiotics, no added hormones, and no steroids. Only at Carl's Jr.
Hamburgers are really kind of the quintessential American food.
Brad Haley is the chief marketing officer for Carl's Jr. and Hardee's Restaurants.
They're on the menus at almost every restaurant, and more recently, over the last few years, you can even find them in virtually every fine dining restaurant.
Americans eat 16 billion burgers a year, or 50 billion. It depends on which study you read. But according to the USDA, we're actually eating less beef than we used to. The numbers have been going down pretty steadily since the 1970s, and people like Haley are trying to figure out why.
And the thing that kept coming up in all of our conversations with millennials and research with millennials was they wanted their food to be as clean as they could get it.
And there's a growing number of ranchers who are bringing clean food to the marketplace. Like Steve Jacobs, who runs the J Brand Cattle Company with his wife Marcy. I rode along with him for 3 hours. That's the time it took for him to feed his cows alfalfa from the back of his truck.
We're in West Petaluma. We're on an 800-acre ranch that I lease, and I've got two herds here.
This is just one of the many ranches throughout Sonoma, Marin, and Napa counties where Jacobs grazes his cattle.
Grass-fed beef is there on open pasture as you'd envision driving up Sonoma County coast or the 101 corridor and seeing beautiful pasture with beef raised. They're not in enclosed, confined dry lots.
The USDA standard for grass-fed certification requires animals be fed only grass and forage or hay, and no grain or grain byproducts. But Jacob says any beef you eat starts out that way.
At some point in time, the large majority of cattle are grass-fed and then finished on grain.
In feedlots.
If you have ever driven down, for example, to Disneyland, you pass through a town called Kalinga, where there's a major feedlot there. You can smell it 10 miles north or 10 miles south. I'm not going to mention any names.
But I can name names. On its website, Harris Ranch describes itself as a modern feedlot that covers nearly 800 acres and has the capacity to produce 250,000 head of fed cattle per year. At any given time, there are 70,000 or more cattle in the lot. That means that each cow gets an average of no more than 1/100th of an acre. That's about the size of two parking spaces or a parklet.
They will go in the feedlot to last 3 months of their life, and they gain a lot there at that feedlot because they're given all the grain they want.
James Olchin is with the Department of Animal Science at UC Davis.
And of course, the more hormones, the more things you use, the less environmental costs you have, because you basically are making that animal more efficient. So if you use grain-fed beef, you're using a whole lot less land, and actually less labor and other things too to produce the beef. That's why it's cheaper.
So the biggest cost by far raising beef is the cost of the land. There's some labor involved. Almost all of our grain comes from the Midwest, so water is the big issue. Water's always the issue for cattle production in the state because that's what dictates how much grass grows on the rangeland.
The U.S. Geological Survey reports that it takes 460 gallons of water to produce a quarter pound of beef. So all of these factors, the water, the land, the labor, they're all minimized at the feedlot. It's a bottom-line business. Savings get passed on to consumers, making animal protein affordable for people of all incomes. And by the way, Olchin doesn't think the cows in most feedlots are mistreated.
They're just pretty happy there.
Though maybe not as happy as Steve Jacobs' cows back in Marin County. Jacobs says his cows roam on about 8 acres per head. So figure around 800 times more land than the ones who finish their lives at the feedlot.
There's definite purpose for feedlots. And my point of being with you today is not to badmouth feedlots. It's not. My point is to point out that there's other alternatives, and this is an alternative, and why is my alternative more expensive than the other guys? And this is why. It's just reality. It's just a fact.
As we drive from one herd to another in his big pickup, it's clear his cows take a lot more land and a lot more labor. And there's another cost. Jacob says a grain-fed cow can go to market after a year and a half. But for one of his cows that never leaves the pasture, it can take up to an extra year.
What I'm doing with my cattle company is raising beef locally that the consumer knows is raised to a certain standard that I follow, of certain protocols that I follow regarding the humane treatment and raising of beef cattle. Those protocols also increase my cost significantly.
Costs that are reflected in the premium price shoppers will pay when they buy his grass-fed beef at markets in Healdsburg and other nearby towns.
There's a lot of families that can't afford it. And that, you know, your heart goes out. But, you know, you don't want a family to go, oh my gosh, I'm not being able to provide the best product to my family because I can't afford to buy $10 ground beef and $35 New York strips. You do the best you can, and you buy what you can buy.
At Carl's Jr., that would be the lower-priced regular burger. According to Brad Haley, it's still their most popular. In 2014, burger chains grossed about $70 billion in sales. That's a whole mountain of meat.
It's difficult to find that much volume of grass-fed, free-range cattle that have no added hormone steroids or antibiotics domestically, but it's hard for chains of our size to do so because there just isn't that much in the world. So we did go to Australia to find that beef.
From about 250 independent ranchers across southern Australia, with average herds of 400 cows on 1,000-acre plots. So they may be grass-fed, but they're certainly not local. Does all this work to raise a more natural cow change the flavor of the beef? Only one way to find out.
Hi, my Dakota, please.
I want to try the all-natural burger.
Okay, you like the single meat or you like the double meat?
Single meat. Let's see, the all-natural burger is $5.99.
Yes.
Local comedian Will Durst joined me at a Carl's Jr. He considers himself something of a cheeseburger expert.
What would be the comparable burger to that? The Famous Star?
That's a regular hamburger.
And that's only $3.45.
We retreat to a back booth for the taste test.
I actually have a blindfold for you, too,
Will.
Do
you really?
I made it myself.
You know, with the lettuce and the tomato and the sauce and the burger, it's pretty good.
The next one now.
Okay, this is the next one. That one's got more of a charbroil feel to it. But I'll be honest, Ryan, I can't really tell the difference. I don't know which is the $5.50 all natural burger and which is the $3.45 Big Star. I couldn't tell you.
So whether you can taste the difference or not, an argument could be made that either or even neither is better. But that's another story. For Cross Currents, I'm Ryan Miller.
You can hear other stories considering the true cost of fish, wine, and plastic bags at klw.org. Click Cross Currents.
If you want something that's good and hot, just eat a hamburger, it'll hit the spot. You can see them on the griddle going flippity-flop. Makes you want to do the boogie to the hamburger hop. They're open up 24 hours a day, just waiting and...
Betinho tem uma proposta decorosa pra te fazer. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. There are hidden costs attached to almost everything we buy. T-shirts, mortgages, and yes, hamburgers. In his book, The Value of Nothing, How to Reshape Market Society and Redefine Democracy, Raj Patel argues that even a hamburger may have hidden ecological and social costs of as much as $200. In his book, Patel also shows concern that global food aid organizations sometimes do more harm than good. So I sat down with Raj Patel and asked, with so much hunger worldwide, does he think international food aid is working?
It would be a mistake to say that these international organizations aren't working. Mm-hmm. They are working. It's just that what they're doing is bad. The organizations, for example, like the World Bank or the International Monetary Fund or these large international policy-making institutions, they're pushing a model where what we need to do is have global markets in food, and that somehow will bring the price down, and that will connect poor people around the world to a global market on which they can sell their food and buy their food. And when the market distributes food, you introduce two very simple rules. The first rule is if you have money, you get to eat, no matter if that food comes from halfway around the world, no matter if that food has huge environmental impacts. If you can afford it, you get to eat it. The second rule, though, is that if you have no money, you starve. And that's why we've seen a number of contradictory things. We've seen the price of food falling, and yet the number of people who are going hungry is going up. The trouble is that global market is also a mechanism for transmitting these huge shocks that we've had over the past couple of years.
So if these big institutions aren't working, should it just be localized to, I donate to my local food bank, and these canned vegetables go to that family?
I think localizing control over the food system is a very good idea. And in fact, that's not my idea. That is the outcome of a study called Agriculture at the Crossroads. And this was 400 of the world's top scientists. And they asked the question, look, in 2050, when there are 9 billion people on Earth, how are we going to feed the world? And the answer they came up with was very interesting. The answer they came up with was, we're going to need to reorient our agriculture to make it, firstly, more local, as you were saying, but also to change the way in which we grow. So, farms that are near cities. Mm-hmm. I mean, for here, us in the Bay Area, that's easy enough. Mm. And so it is through local initiatives that we will be able to feed the hungry. But it's not necessarily through food banks. I mean, think about what a food bank is. A food bank is an amazing institution filled with very committed people who are there to take the edge off hunger for the poor. A food bank is not in the business of eradicating poverty. And if, as we say, the reason people go hungry is because of poverty, then we really need to tackle the root causes. Advocacy for jobs in the community, for example, social services in the community, responsive government in the community, so that people never get so poor, that they have to rely on food banks. And I think those kinds of local initiatives are what we need to be aiming towards.
That's interesting because there are these endless charities here in the U.S. and California where you donate money to be sent to a hungry community somewhere else in the world. Why doesn't aid solve the problem? For the same reason you just mentioned?
Well, I mean, food aid, it's something we should do, but we should do properly. The way that the US food aid system, and for a long time the European food aid system worked, was to use food aid as a way of getting rid of the surplus that was being grown in this country or in Europe. In other words, it was a way of getting rid of stuff that was surplus to requirements in a way that was inescapably political. Again, this isn't a conspiracy theory on my part. You can find it openly admitted in USAID documents or even by the US Secretary of Agriculture, Earl Butz, who admitted that food is a weapon in the US arsenal. And so food aid was a way of dumping food in foreign countries. But when you do that, think of it from the perspective of a farmer in a developing country. You know, the farmer, I mean, there's hard times, there's a food shortage. The farmer is struggling to be able to sell their food on the open market because people are so poor. I mean, people want food, don't get me wrong, there's a food shortage, but because people are poor, there's not necessarily the purchasing power to keep this farmer producing food. The farmer's trying as hard as she can. And then the food comes in from the United States or from Europe, and it's being loaded off the boat and it's been given away for free. What does that do to the farmer? Of course, it wipes them out. No farmer can compete with free. And so, you know, the process of food aid actually ends up decimating local agricultural capacity.
So what do? You stop the food aid? People go hungry?
Funnily enough, you do what foodies in the United States have been encouraging us to do for a long time. You buy local. You buy food aid from within the region. Pretty much every country except the United States has now agreed that this aid where you ship it around the world on a U.S. boat, that's a bad idea. We need to take our citizenship seriously. It's not something that you can merely sort of give a couple of dollars and forget that you're a citizen. I think we need to decommodify citizenship.
In your book, The Value of Nothing, you talk about the true price of food. Mm. That just fascinated me. You say that something that is seemingly cheap, like a burger, is actually much more expensive in reality. Can you explain that?
Yes. I mean, there was a study done about the true cost of a hamburger. And the analysts sort of took a $4 hamburger and said, look, if this hamburger was grown on rainforest that was clear cut and turned into pasture, then the services that rainforest was providing in terms of biodiversity, in terms of water, in terms of carbon sequestration, all those services have a dollar value. And if you add up that that number, the average hamburger shouldn't cost $4, it should cost $200. One in five U.S. healthcare dollars is spent looking after someone who has diabetes. One in five healthcare dollars, $174 billion a year, spent on taking care of someone who has this illness that's in many ways diet-related. Those costs never figure into the cost of our food. It's not that we don't pay those costs. It's just that they're not there in the price. And I think that's why in The Value of Nothing, I talk about how cheap food is actually cheat food. The cheat is that we're not given the real cost of that food, but other people get to profit from it while we have to shoulder the cost.
That was Raj Patel, author of the book The Value of Nothing. You can find links to more food and environment coverage at KELW.org and click on Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hana Baba. Watching Bay Area singer Karina Denike perform is like going back in time to an era of torch singers. You can hear a lifetime of musical influences in her music, a jazz vocalist's depth mixed with a punk edge, a little doo-wop, an Eastern European lilt, and some 1960s soul. Denike was born to Czech parents in England and grew up on the road, doing street theater with her mom and brother throughout Europe and India before moving to the East Bay at the age of 12. In this episode of Bay Area Beats, Denike talks about how being a teenager in Berkeley brought it all together.
I remember going to Willard Junior High and being in complete culture shock, and was pretty funny because I had traveled so much as a kid, but the States was a big culture shock actually. But then, of course, there was the beauty of this place, which is just, you know, still stunning to me. Like, the wildness and the freeness of Berkeley was pretty impressive to me. And in some ways, it actually felt the most like home for us. This album, the title Under Glass, comes from sort of the first song that I ever wrote on this instrument, which I... For this album, and this instrument that I have, which I'm gonna turn on, but so I'll play a little bit for you. But So this is a chord organ. This particular one is built by Farfisa, and on the front it says piano organ. So I started writing, the first song that I wrote was called Musée Mécanique, and the title of the record is called Under Glass, which is a lyric within Musée Mécanique, the song. And it just really sounded to me like this kind of, you know, honky-tonk kind of pirate instrument that you would probably just have on a boat and play. So the lullaby is a song my mother used to sing to me when I was little, falling asleep. Až budeš velký, when you are grown. That's what it means. I spoke Czech as a child, so to me, I think those words are just the mood and the feeling of that, of what the lyrics are, will always sort of remain with me somehow. Hi. Sleep, little baby, sleep. Your father is away on a ship, and we're hoping he'll become home safe. And one day, when you grow up, you will also go on a ship and leave me. It's pretty dark, you know. So Under Glass, the whole concept to me is about preservation in this particular situation. The song Musée Mécanique is about preservation also, but I felt like the whole record captures these moments in time for me over the last few years, my songwriting process. It's also capturing moments in time in some ways to referencing sort of eras of music. So we've got a sort of a 30s-ish sort of cabaret-ish bar song, barroom sort of tune, a little bit of something that sounds more 50s rock and roll, and then these sort of what I think of as sailor songs. To me, these are parts of me and parts of my influences, and it's a preservation in that sense of time and of history. I'm really interested in nostalgia and the past. What shall we do with the drunken sailor? I'm trying to be more positive about the changes. I've been pretty distraught about the changes in San Francisco. To me, this is such an incredible city, and its beauty has just always been overwhelming to me. I'm going through a huge grateful phase of just being completely inspired and just delighted by so many amazing musicians here, so much creativity. I'm kind of floored on a daily basis anytime I go to a show or hear someone's new record or, you know, see someone's incredible piece that they've been working on. I feel like this community is incredibly strong still, even with all these changes. Down,
down, down. That was Bay Area singer Karina Denike. The piece was produced by KLW's Julie Kane. You can see Denike perform songs from her new album, Under Glass, on January 29th at Slim's in San Francisco. All the information is at KLW.org. Click Cross Currents. Our team includes Geraldine Asu, Audrey Dilling, Tammy Drummond, Angela Johnston, Casey Miner, James Rollins, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. The line producer was Leela Day. Our managing editor is Jen Sheehan. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. And we're going to send you off today with a story from KALW's My Mixtape Project, our series about significant songs in people's lives. Here's San Francisco artist Scott Kildall on his song, David Bowie's Space Oddity. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom.
I remember listening to that song when I was a kid, and I was with my parents and asking them, what the hell does that mean? What is this person floating in a capsule? And my parents explained to me about space travel and astronauts and what they were doing. And it, to me, that song also represents the difference between the dreams of space travel and the reality of sitting in a tin can where you're isolated and subject to danger.
Check ignition and may God's love be with you.
So I like to work between the imaginary and the real, and somewhere in that translation is, I think, where you have the possibility for an amazing artistic expression.
This is ground control.